Hello and welcome to the True Blue LA podcast. No baseball on, but we're still going to blab away, aren't we, Eric?
We certainly are. Hello, everybody. We talked about this like in wanting to go back to weekly episodes to keep us occupied, but also like some weeks we realized that with no baseball and sometimes no real news, that we're just going to be sort of scraping the bottom of the barrel of ideas. And this week might be one of those weeks, but I think we figured out a decent amount of things to riff about. So, I mean, we talked about Monopoly last week, so we're going to at least match that.
And we are going to again today.
Yeah.
Which is going to become a Monopoly podcast.
That's right. This week, the thimble versus the hat, which is better.
We've got a grab bag. Maybe Monopoly will make it, maybe it won't. We've got, you have a Dodgers rewind for us, I believe. And we've got questions from Craig, all that after this.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with The Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
You got to experience this week something that I've had a few times, lifting the curtain a little bit. I think this is generally known, but just in case, I'm sort of the, or was for a while, the only technical person on the podcast. And we've since offloaded a lot of that to Editor Brian, much to my joy, because he's much, much better at it and stresses them out. I hopefully way less than it stressed me out. But I'm still generally the person recording it and coming up with kind of ideas to kind of make the sound better and do the technical side of it. You largely have just been, you've just been the talent, as they say.
Yeah. I guess I I'm the dummy who talks into a microphone and goes, do we got it? You know, like, and then, that's kind of it. But yeah, this week, I've sort of jumped on that bandwagon trying to figure out ways to improve the sound. It's not always easy because, you know, we're not, we don't have professional studio or anything, and we're recording over the internet, so we're sort of at mercy to that sometimes. But trying to improve the sound quality, hopefully that happens this week. Let us know in the comments if you think the audio has improved this week, and we'll see if what we did worked.
It's become a mantra of sorts in these sort of weird times that we're kind of alone but together kind of thing. Like, we're all having to be alone at the same time. So you and I are kind of getting through this, but the Dodgers and the people on the Dodgers staff also going through this also know that, you know, they as a brand, as a business, are in entertainment. They need to be doing something. They're doing, you know, granted they've got some money in the coffers. The Dodgers do, but they're still trying to generate some amount of interest. I know there's one thing you wanted to talk about. Did you see another Vin Scully video came out talking about the construction going on?
Yeah, so they, like, you know, they sort of packaged aerial shot, like a drone shot of the updates, the construction updates at Dodger Stadium, and then they just, you know, there's no better way to present something like that than let's just have Vin Scully narrate it, and it's of course like perfect. So that was fun.
What I liked about the video, I don't know if you could tell, but the audio quality was clearly Vin from his home, maybe on a Zoom call or something. Just like, wasn't the perfect studio audio quality, at least from my ears, which makes me similar to the video they released of Vin a couple of weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, I guess, where it's nice to know that Vin has gone from old-timey radio to Zoom calls for his professional voice career.
I think we, I should I should inquire and see if I can record one of our episodes from Vin Scully's house. And it's one of those like, well, will you have Vin Scully on the show? Well, I don't want to impose. I just want to record from his house just to see what the audio quality is like. Like you said, we're looking to improve the audio any way we can. But yeah, so like the Dodger stuff they're putting out, we've seen the workout sessions with Brandon McDaniel. It's Mondays and Fridays in the morning. They have another thing. I think it's called, what is it? Friday night at the Sunset Strip. It's like Ross Stripling does a Zoom interview with a player. That's been kind of fun. Like a couple weeks ago, Kike Hernandez was on and like he's got his sort of quarantine, facial hair going and, it's fun. But, yeah, the other thing, and then like Joe Davis and Oral Hershiser, obviously they'd be calling games, but they don't have games, but they've been like keeping in touch. And they decided to cut in on our racket and they have a podcast now and it's pretty good. So that's fun. They've had Dave Roberts on. I think he's sort of the like regular guest every episode. I think next week they're having Clayton Kershaw on. So yeah, that's worth a listen. I've listened to the first two, it was good. But another thing that Joe Davis has been doing sporadically, if you follow him on Instagram, he'll occasionally post like a shorter video on Twitter, but he just films himself like cooking all the time. And it's a lot of using his big green egg outside. And like, he's just searing meat a lot and like just smoking various meats. And it's gorgeous. And it's just, I mean, look, it's like not safe for work sometimes to watch. It's like, so any like quality food show or just where you're just seeing this mouthwateringly like awesome like food, it's pretty great. And plus just like you talked about like Vin Scully narrating something, Joe Davis has an awesome voice. And it's like just him at home, like imagine that, like it's like he's calling himself doing this, and it's like, you know, having a professional narrate his own life, which is kind of weird and fun. But the one thing that drew my eye this week, so they actually packaged one of these little videos, the Dodgers did. And it was like a 4-minute video. I think they put it up on YouTube and Twitter, probably Facebook too. And it's just called Cooking with Joe. And he did this like giant tomahawk ribeye. He seared it on one grill. Then he smoked it in the big green egg for a little bit. And just all sorts of bastings and dry rubs and various flavor injections in there. And then when he pulled it off of the grill, it's this like gigantic piece of meat, but he put it on this, I couldn't see exactly what the cutting board said, but it's a high-end cutting board. It looks awesome. I think it says Davis, I'm assuming, under like in the wood in the middle, but I can't see that. What drew me to it is the handles on the sides of the cooking board, little baseball bats. I really enjoyed that. So that was probably my highlight of last week, Dodgers related.
Why do you think it says just, Davis? You think he's a Garfield Jim Davis fan?
He is, yeah. No, he's a fan of Ron Davis, who pitched for the Yankees in the 81 World Series against the Dodgers. So
did he go to UC Davis, perhaps?
The father of Ike Davis? Yeah. No. Okay. No, he's a Midwestern kid. The other random thing that I sort of added this late because I saw something tonight on it, not even Dodgers related at all, but it always makes me laugh, and it doesn't require baseball to be going on, but Nationals beat writer Mark Zuckerman, he all the time he retweets stuff because he usually has fun with it, but all sorts of people mistake him for the head of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg. But they tweet at Mark Zuckerman, and like I'm just gonna read you this tweet that was sent to him today. I don't remember what it was replying to, but it said, "Hey Mark Zuckerman, ever heard of the First Amendment? Yeah, I'm thinking that scares the bejesus out of you. One day when you finally decide to think for yourself, you know, when you grow up here and realize you're a man, oh, what the hell, that'll be too fucking late." So that's just the
kind of, we'd gone a few weeks without the explicit tag, and I think we would have done it another week if it wasn't for a sassy sculptor on Twitter. So
that's right. Yeah, I didn't realize that was his name. That's hilarious. Sassy Sculptor. Thank you, Sassy Sculptor. But look, we're probably gonna have better audio this week, I'm assuming. So you gotta break it in, right?
Sure.
We're like The Last Dance on ESPN. They broadcast the word fuck quite a bit during that the first two episodes of that 10-part Bulls documentary. They had an ESPN2 feed that didn't, they edited out the curse words, but it was kind of nice to see Michael Jordan occasionally go, man, fuck these guys.
Is ESPN, is that the family ESPN?
Yeah, I guess, I don't know how they like justified it.
Were the broadcast times different? That would make sense.
No, well, it was 6 o'clock Pacific, 9 o'clock Eastern. So like it was right there. Like I don't know how you could just be like, yeah, it's fine. But like,
whatever. It's just like the idea of ESPN2 for the family.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
For the kids.
Yeah.
Who want to learn about Michael Jordan.
Yeah. Who knows? Another thing we're sort of, I guess we don't talk about this a lot on the podcast, which is probably a detriment to me and to us, but, just like talk about stuff on the site sometimes, because hey, we are the True Blue LA podcast. And
wait, we are?
Yeah, and I don't know if you heard, but our industry is having a rough go, and it would be cool if you clicked on the site once in a while just to check it out. That'd be nice. So yeah, check these things out. We're Blake Harris and I. We are running these watch parties, just basically looking at old games on YouTube and then following along as if it were a real live game thread. It's fun for these, especially like seeing some old stuff maybe that people haven't seen or they haven't seen in a long time. We're doing these every Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, 5 p.m. during the week and 4 p.m. on Saturday. We could probably adjust it on Saturday if, depending on how people sort of react. It was a lesser crowd on Saturday than during the week, but that's understandable even if folks have weird schedules these days. But last week, what did we do? The 1981 World Series Game 6. Blake's going to do every game of the 88 playoffs. He started with NLCS Game 1 last week. He's going to do Game 2 this week. And then on Saturday, I did the 1988 MLB All-Star Game. And then this week, I'm going to do games 5 and 7 of the 1965 World Series. Both games were Sandy Koufax versus Jim Cott. They both pitched on 2 days rest in game 7. Just craziness. But I have never seen game 5, which was at Dodger Stadium, and the full video of that's on YouTube. So we're going to watch that. It's kind of fun. Another sort of project I'm doing at the site is, I write weekend reviews every year, every season for the Dodgers, like every single week. Just sort of going over who did what the previous week. And since I don't have a season to do that with, I'm doing this for the 1920 Dodgers, which is, it's a challenge because I'm going mostly off box scores for this. And there is some sporting news stuff that I can find. And, there's a couple famous games, and this isn't a spoiler alert or anything, but like, this has the longest game in Major League history, a 26-inning game. The Dodgers also made the World Series that year. It was their second pennant ever, and it was like their last for like 21 years before they were good again. Pretty exciting season, just relative to their like Brooklyn history. So I'm learning a lot as I go, but we'll see how that goes. It could be a challenge, but also it's just a little fun exercise each week. I can note on the Angel site, Halos Heaven, I'm similarly doing one for the 1979 Angels, for which there is a little better number of like source material I can go to if I want to get like the accounts of the day. That's been a fun exercise. So I like doing that kind of stuff once a week. So that's up on the site. I also interviewed Dieter Ruhl last week, Dodgers organist, also the LA Kings organist. He was probably at that game we were trying to figure out a couple weeks ago that you were at during spring break or something. I should have asked him about actually thinking about it.
But how long has he been the Kings organist?
I was looking at this, I think, since around 1990. We didn't exactly get into how long he's been there. I talked to him. I'm going to have a feature up at some point this week, maybe Tuesday, most likely Wednesday or so. But yeah, so writing about him, it was fun. I think that'll be fun. So look for that on the site this week. That's what we got going on.
I assume after you realized that we didn't have much to go on here, that you reached out to some listeners and hopefully fill the weeds a little bit.
I have to just full disclosure here. This was a couple weeks ago when we first went back to the recording every week. Mm-hmm. And we sort of asked Craig late, like, oh, yeah, we're recording. Can you send us questions from Craig? And we weren't sure if he was going to get him in on time, which would have been fine because we didn't give him any notice. Honestly, like, even if we did, it's like, whatever. He doesn't have to send us questions. It's cool that he does. But he did. But as we were waiting, I put out a tweet. This was 2 weeks ago, asking for questions. And the only one we answered on that podcast was a sort of a joke one when someone said, who is the best musician like in Dodgers history or something? And that prompted me to note about Bill Singer, who got the first save in Major League history. So that was a nice little segue. But I looked back, and there were a couple questions that we can sort of go into that still are, you know, relatively evergreen that we can just address now.
First from Keith Cook. Raul Mondesi versus Yasiel Puig in Battle of Network Stars style contest of throwing. Who wins? Pitching velocity, throwing to football, javelin?
I wonder about this. There's no StatCast data for Raul Mondesi, but he's nicknamed El Cañon. I mean, that's got to count for at least like 5 miles an hour extra. I really don't know the answer to this. Like, from a pure athletic standpoint, like, Yasiel Puig is like a physical specimen, like looks like a NFL linebacker, basically. I would be, if it's just throwing, I think Mondesi has a chance, but the more you incorporate other sort of events into this Battle of the Network Stars type thing, I think Puig has an advantage probably. But man, if it's just pure arm, Mondesi might be up there. He was really good. If it's just arm, I'd lean Mondesi, but I think it's really close.
I think specifically because we have Battle of the Network Stars, I'm going to assume showmanship is at least, if not for the final score, how I root with my heart. So I'm going to go Yasiel Puig.
It's one of those, if it's like, you know, the producers of the TV show.
Do you know who's rooting for who, though? You're just going to hear a bunch of ooh, ooh.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And even if they do something like, if like say their base running is in there and Puig gets like picked off and they're booing him, like, are they rooting for Raul? Like, what are they doing? Who knows?
From David Young, if baseball doesn't have a season at all, does that mean that for the players that have options left, they didn't use one? Given Major League service time is being awarded, do the Dodgers not lose a year of control of, say, Rusdo Graterol? Which we looked up how to say that name, and I practice so hard, but I haven't cared about baseball, so I'm sure I butchered it. I apologize.
We're not quite in practice yet, but yeah, no, I wanted to get to this. I think, I can't remember if I answered Dave directly on Twitter on this or not, but just generally, the agreement that was reached March 27th, I believe, between the players and Major League Baseball regarded some sort of a guaranteed salary should the season be canceled, plus an agreement on service time. And it's basically this: if there's no season, every player who appeared in 2019 gets their exact service time from last year. So like a Mookie Betts or whatever, he gets a full season, right? But for Graterol and Gavin Lux, they both happened to have, I believe, 29 days each last year in their first debut. So, like, we spent like a lot of time this offseason wondering, like, if the Dodgers were going to play like service time games with Lux in a normal season to like delay his free agency by a year. But like, if there's no season, like, they're sort of back. They're not quite back at square one, but those two would just get another 29 days. So they'd be at like 58 days going into next year. In terms of options, there's no real options to use because there's no minor leagues technically right now. All the minor league contracts are suspended. So there's no way for players to assign players to leagues. So like, just from a technical standpoint, no, but I think practically too, there's no season. They're not getting options. So they're not like losing an option year or anything like that. Now, if it's, if it is a shortened season, I believe the agreement for pay is that the players lose one 162nd for every game that's missed in terms of pay. The season itself is 186 days normally. I think that gets prorated depending on how long the season is. So let's say let's say they manage to mix in 120 game season, you're looking at roughly it's like you're playing 2/3 of a season. So if a player accumulates, say, 70 days or something like that, he'd get maybe the equivalent of just over 100. This is just like a total spitballing. I don't have the exact numbers, but that's roughly what it is. It's basically prorated if it's a shorter season and just a repeat of last year. So like other players who didn't appear last year and they're just added to the 40-man, they wouldn't get any service time at all. So it's, I mean, everyone loses a year. This sucks no matter what if that happens. So, but in terms of like service time and stuff, that's basically how it's mapped out.
And I think the next one, I'm going to let you handle it. I don't think it's from a listener. I think it's from you, meant to torture me.
It is. And another thing that's on the site, Blake Harris has been tirelessly working at getting like sort of these all-time ranking types things. And like he most of it is war-based, you know, just basically looking at Fangraphs and Baseball Reference War and ranking both all-time Dodgers and single season Dodgers, like, and he's doing 100 of each one. So one that came up this last week was Maury Wills, his 1962 season, when he set the record with 104 steals. There are a lot of like little ancillary things that I love about that season. One is that he was only caught 13 times, which is ridiculous. But also I was looking this up. So Ty Cobb stole like 96 bases. I think it was 1915. I don't have it in front of me, but roughly then, 1915. From that point to Wills, I think five total people stole even 60 bases, and like no one was really more than that. And then Wills went 104. And then a couple years later, he stole 94 bases in 1965. And then no one really approached that till the early 70s with Lou Brock, and then Lou Brock broke Will's record in 1974 with 118 steals. But then Brock was also caught like over 30 times. So Will's very efficient on the bases, but also this weird thing about that season, he stole third base. What am I asking? Okay. I don't want to tell you this because it's part of the question. I'll just say this Wills led the league in steals for six straight years from 1960 to 65. The question I'm asking you is for this four-year period, 62, which was his 104 steal season, to 65 when he stole 94. One, how many times did Maury Wills steal third base? And two, what was the total of the second place finisher in MLB stealing third base during that span?
Okay, I will make up an answer, and I will guess it in about however long a commercial takes. This is a fun trivia question because not only do I have to figure out how likely I think Wills was to steal third, just in general how in vogue that such a maneuver was. So I'm going to be wildly. I was thinking about this before we went on as I was reading. The Torturous. You have another one coming up for me, and I've really been thinking about that one.
Yeah. That one is kind of a weird, fun one.
It's a hint. It's a spoiler. It's a small sample size question, which is my bread and butter. I love small sample size questions. So
now I will give you a couple factoids that may or may not help you here. Mm-hmm. So Wills, in that four-year period, he stole 291 bases. Not only he led the NL all 4 years, but he led major leagues three of those years. And the year he didn't, he was three behind the American League leader. I will give you the hint that the person who stole third the second most amount of times in this four-year span was that American League player. That American League player is also a Hall of Famer.
Okay.
Wills, in those 4 years, led the majors in stealing third all 4 years. And, of course, I had this one. Yeah, he stole at least, I'll give you this, he stole double-digit base, he stole third double-digit times all 4 years.
Okay.
And already nobody, nobody else stole double digits in any of the years.
Okay. So I'm adjusting mine. So I had kind of roughly pegged 10% of the steals were of third. So yeah. I was getting near 29-30 was going to be my guess. That doesn't work given your hint that has to be minimum of 40. I'm going to go guess a little above that, and I will go with 58.
Oh, very close. So Will
202.
Will stole third 53 times. In 59 attempts, just ridiculous accuracy. Now, do you have a guess for what the second place total was, knowing that nobody stole double digit bases in any of those 4 years?
12.
Oh, I wish it was that low. That would be great. However, it is 20.
Okay.
I will give you one more hint about who the person is.
No.
I'll say this person is a Hall of Famer, which I told you. He led the American League in steals in each of his first 9 seasons. He was a shortstop.
Nope. Passing.
Luis Aparicio.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. I wasn't going to get to the name anytime soon.
He stole third base 20 times. He was second in 1963 and 64 with 7 times stealing third. Tommy Harper in 1965 of the Reds stole 8 third times, which was half of what Wills did. Wills went 16, 10, 11, 16. Now, in 1962, Maury Wills won the MVP, and Willie Mays finished second. He also finished second with 6 steals of third in 1962. So I thought that was interesting.
I do too.
Yep.
You know what else I think is interesting? Dodger rewinds.
Now, what's funny about this, or sort of funny, sometimes I have a reason for doing these, and for the life of me, I can't remember the reason I thought of doing this player. I think I just stumbled upon him at some point. Now, I will say this. It's a catcher named Joe Dunn. Now, he only played for the Dodgers for 30 games in 1908-1909, so it's peak dead ball era. He hit 169, 178, 213. He was nicknamed Bullets for his strong throwing arm. He was 15 for 89 in those 30 games, so he barely played. This is going to lead into the trivia question here.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite part, though, is like, he filled in for Bill Bergen, who is like considered the worst hitter in Major League history, who got like any like extended playing time. He was out for the year after a collision at home plate. Now, another thing that about Dunn, he started off hot against the Hall of Famer. I'm reading this from his Saber bio. Dunn's first at bat for the Superbus, editor's note, that's what the Dodgers were called back then, was against Christy Mathewson on September 12th. This is 1908. And he launched a double to the right field fence that scored 2 runs. His next time up, Dunn ripped a single. In his fourth trip, he slashed a grounder that nearly took Herzog's foot away, according to the Brooklyn Eagle. The hot shot was ruled an error, though the Eagle said that 9 out of 10 scorers would have called it a hit. So he's 2 for 4, and like a lot of people think, okay, he's probably really 3 for 4. But then he only had like 13 other hits the rest of the way. So not your best hitter. Now, my trivia question for you before I get into the rest of Joe Dunn's career. Which LA Dodger has the worst OPS plus all time, minimum 50 plate appearances? Now, Dunn had 94 plate appearances, and his OPS plus was 26. The man he was replacing was Bill Bergen, who's actually 16. So technically, Dunn wasn't worse than Bergen. But imagine that, over 2,000 plate appearances, and Bill Bergen had a 16 OPS plus. Now, the worst pitcher is this is non-pitcher, by the way.
Okay.
Worst pitcher is Mark Hendrickson, minus 61. He was 1 for 46. Now, do you have any guesses? I will actually accept 2 for this because I didn't notice the actual answer before this, and I like this other answer so much better. So either one I will accept.
I'm going to ask for 1 hint.
Yeah.
The reason I was struggling with this is so many players that I associate as the bad offensive players it's more, oh, they had a bad season, but then they had another good one, and that kind of balances out. Luis Cruz, during kind of in between you and I talking, I've been looking up Dodger seasons and just glancing at OPS Plus and reminding me of some of these short-lived names that appeared.
Both of these answers are one-season wonders. Or, you know, not wonders, but one season with the Dodgers. The actual answer was a Philly, known for being a Philly, I would say. And his season with the Dodgers was 1996.
Okay. That's I was 10, so.
Yeah.
I knew Hideo Nomo at the time.
Factoring in the other answer just was a actually productive hitter in his other years, not with the Dodgers. The son of a former major leaguer, and he was a Dodger in 2003.
Yep, I'll tap out, but I have some follow up questions once you tell me.
Okay, so the actual answer is Milt Thompson, an outfielder who was had 57 plate appearances. He was 6 for 51 with a double and 6 walks. He had a -3 OPS. And then the other answer from 2003 in 114 plate appearances, Darryl Ward.
Okay.
His OPS plus was 9.
My webcam is broken. I have Darryl Ward written on my name. I didn't say it because that was after I was looking through a list.
I see.
Now, my follow up question to you is if you knew the answer for 100 plate appearances, and I was curious if.
All right.
That makes me a little happier.
And we'll note that Darryl Ward had a 95 OPS plus for his career, so almost league average. I haven't figured it out since it was like the middle of his career when he was with the Dodgers, and he was like in his prime at 28, which just that was also the year they had Fred McGriff, who like just completely fell off.
That was the worst thing. I was having fun looking down on the like 100 plate appearances per season, going back and forth. Is there some really interesting names?
it is there. And I was having, so like I even did the search on Baseball Reference like to weed out the non pitchers, and for some reason Bob Welch kept showing up in the search. And so I'll just say he actually batted 667 times in 10 years with the Dodgers, and his OPS plus was 2, which is just fun. That's just awesome. Okay, so back to our friend Joe Dunn. Mm-hmm. He managed 17 years in the minors, and this was when minors were unaffiliated, so they weren't like tied to a team. He won 3 league titles early on with a team in Indiana, Bloomington, and then he's like basically from Springfield, Ohio. He was born there. He died there. He worked for Shell Oil forever from Springfield, but he went back to his town in 1930 and managed the Springfield Blue Sox. And that was one of his league titles in the minors. He and his 2 siblings were owners of that 1930 team. But I read a little bit about this. They were hit hard by the Depression. And I think they ended up at, like, having to either give or like divest their shares to like, I think, the owner of the Tigers or something to get out of it. And I don't have the quote in front of me, but he was like, yeah, baseball ownership is not like, not cool, it was a bad experience for him being an owner. But not many players, especially during that time, can say they were in that position. So yeah, that's Joe Dunn.
Does that leave what I think it leaves us with?
Oh, I think so.
It's time for
Questions for Craig. We love them.
5 questions, probably more than 5 answers, because I guess I'll let you answer. Sometimes I'll answer as well. The first question, as Craig promised, a question about The Simpsons, a show I have a large amount of knowledge about, at least certain seasons. Back to The Simpsons. Can you identify components of an episode that make it a classic, at least through season 10 episode for you? Looking at last week's question, A Fish Called Selma, there was a musical component, a rivalry, and a parody. Can you pinpoint similarities with some of your favorites? So the main us nerds that reviewed and talked about The Simpsons online for many years in the late 90s and early aughts, generally the pinpoint is some will include seasons 9, some will include season 10. I am a seasons 1 through 9er is where I deem classic era. Mm-hmm. The main difference is sort of the crudeness of the humor and the sort of lack of tenderness in the characters. It kind of becomes a rush from joke to joke. Jerk Homer is a thing you'll hear quoted a lot, as Homer becomes more and more of a jerk. He becomes less sort of bounded by sort of a love of the characters and more is just an excuse to rip through jokes. And that's definitely the main component I sort of notice. The jokes per minute stays about the same. If not, if anything, it kind of gets ramped up a little bit. But sort of the cohesion of tender treatment of the characters is what I would say kind of makes seasons kind of 3 through 8 the best seasons and 1 through 9 the good ones.
I like that.
We should, you and I could do, you know, we got nothing else to talk about most weeks, so you and I should rank our Simpsons episodes at some point. Whoa. I have a pretty firm top 3-ish, and then I have to think about the ones after that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we'll get there at some point, and I'm guessing sometime in May at the latest.
Next week.
Yeah, right.
Most likely to happen the next 10 seasons. Dodger player hitting 49 or more doubles. The last one to do that was Sean Green in 2003. Hitting 160 more singles. Juan Pierre did that in 2007. Or getting 100 or more walks. Gary Sheffield in 2000.
I was thinking about this. So 49 doubles is the LA Dodger record. The only one with more was Johnny Frederick in like 1930 with 52. For hits, I think the players on the Dodgers now who are most likely to get the most hits hit for too much power to have 160 singles.
There's not a lot of banjo hitters around.
Yeah.
So the singles, I think Juan Pierce safe. Pop the champagne. That's out.
So I think this basically is a race between and then also like Jock Peterson, when he came up, he walked like 90 times, but then he's also more of a platoon player. At least that's how he's used. Max Muncy, I think, can get there. So I think this question is basically a race between Corey Seager and Max Muncy. and I think Seager has a 50 double season in him. So I would probably bet on that. At the same time, it wouldn't surprise me if Muncy one of these years walked 100. He's been like closing in on it. So, but I think I would pick Seager to get to 49 or more. So yeah, I think that's my pick.
This is just another ring in a box for Juan Pierre, single king of the LA Dodgers.
I also need to make a note. We sort of keep track of our predictions and bets and stuff from the podcast. And I was looking, we finally started to do it.
Yeah,
and we haven't even picked anything for a long time. So I'm glad we don't want to like. Something.
Yeah, I guess you and I could pick when is the next actual game of baseball. But
right. Maybe we could do that at some point. Like maybe that. Let's say the next time baseball we can't say sets a date because that let's maybe within 2 weeks we'll try to figure out. Let's pick a date or something.
Sure. Sort of. Have you been watching any of the Taiwanese baseball?
Very little, mostly because it's on super early for me. I think those games start at like 3 a.m. And like I have old man bladder and just being old in general. I randomly wake up sometimes at like 3 or 4 in the morning and I will check my phone. So if I happen to do that, I will check it then. Check the baseball then. But other than that, it's not really so far.
Old friend who got on first for 1,000 hits in the Taiwanese league. I don't know if you saw that.
Oh, I didn't see that. I saw someone make a pun, and I didn't read the article. I thought he was playing first base.
No, he got his.
That's great.
1,000 hit.
Nice. That's pretty nice.
Yeah. No, and he about tipped his cap to the robotic fans that are in the audience. So.
I like that.
How much of the experience of seeing a live music performance is the audience interaction for you? I've been to a couple of festivals and the U2 Joshua Tree concert at the Rose Bowl in the last few years, and I thought crowd reaction was part of the show. Let's just answer that. He has some follow up questions for the both of us, but
yeah. So not to steal Craig's thunder because I saw part of the question, but I will say this: most of the Weird Al shows I've been to involves a lot of singing along.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this last one I went to in August. I went with my cousin Alex, and this was at the amphitheater in Newport Beach. I forgot what it's called, but anyway, we were there, and I just remember there being a divide where there were older fans like me and him who like knew the earlier stuff, but maybe weren't as up on the new stuff. But man, then you could really see what the younger crowd lit up at, but everyone was singing along on a lot of stuff, and I thought that was great. However, the most like involved, like just everyone singing along, I think, was a Tom Petty concert at the Irvine Amphitheater. This was probably 15 years ago. And that we were just sitting on the grass, and Steve Winwood opened that one. But man, like Petty probably sang like 20 songs, and like everyone there was like singing along with all of them, and it was wonderful. So yeah, those are like the two examples I can remember.
He wonders with my musical preferences if I prefer smaller shows where you don't really see the other audience members. So sure, I don't know what you're saying, Craig, like this hipster music, but I've been the Staples, I've been the Greek many a time. I guess I haven't been the Staples for a concert more than once, but I did see Lady Gaga at Staples Center. So,
ooh.
But it's no crowd interaction, I think, is just as big of a deal. I don't say it's a vital component to a great show, but it is one of the ways you can get there to a great show. Nico Case and Glenn Hansard, two artists that I like a lot, are both extremely eloquent at sort of conversing with the audience. I think almost Vin mm-hmm. Scully-esque in having a conversation with the audience, even if they're not actually reacting. Sometimes they are. Sometimes the crowd is actually responding. But really funny, really eloquent, and also just great performers. So,
do they start with each concert with "It's time for music"? I don't know.
Yes. So they do.
That'd be great. So the best, I will say the best, like just crowd experience didn't involve necessarily singing along, although there was some. But U2 in the Elevation tour, so this was like 2001 and 2-ish. I probably saw them like three times on that tour. Maybe the Honda Center twice even, and I think once in San Diego. Man, that was such a good show, and it was the kind like where I got goosebumps like during the concert, like it was that good, and that was just like the feeling in the arena, and like it both like the energy of the band and the crowd itself, and it's not necessarily like you know, singing along, although there were songs where people did sing along, but it was just more like the raw energy in the building was awesome. I loved it. So that was probably the best like crowd experience I've ever had at a concert.
Jacob, do you have a favorite book series or author that you can recommend for the listeners? So I'm a programmer by trade, which I've brought up a few times on the podcast, but my degree is in American literature, which makes no sense when you know me, because I don't seem to be someone that might read a lot. I don't have a lot of books lying around. I don't talk about reading all that much. A lot of that is because I kind of burnt out on reading. When you major in literary criticism, you're kind of that yeah. part of my brain is hard to turn off. So if I'm reading anything sort of high level literature, like I read while I was at school, it's really hard for me to just kind of enjoy it. That said, I have been reading I just started a extremely large fantasy series, because I find that most fantasy is escapist enough that I can kind of read it and not overly engage my brain, which is generally what I'm looking for by the time I'm done working. And that is the Malzahn Book of the Fallen is the name of the series. And it's by your name, evil twin, Steven Erikson.
Whoa.
Just noticed that.
Evil doppelganger.
So, okay. And I've been enjoying that a lot so far. I might think about this a little bit more and you know, kind of go back to my days writing about books and recommend a few. But
I have a few sports books here that I haven't gotten to that I want to. And part of it is like time. Part of it is like, yeah, I don't know if my brain views reading as a chore and doesn't want me to do it. And I just find ways to not do it. But I'm staring right now at Stealing Home by Eric Nussbaum, sort of the backstory behind the Dodgers coming to Los Angeles and building Dodger Stadium. And then also The Cactus League, a fictional book surrounding spring training by Emily Nemens. Looking forward to reading both, just haven't got to it. There was a time in March where I did have time when we were all sort of shutting down a little bit. And it was this weird thing. This is a weird excuse, but it sort of fits. My glasses broke, and I'd spend like...
So many books.
Yeah, exactly. No. And no, but it was like, so I sent it in for repair, and then there was like a snag with the repair, and I had a backup pair of my old prescription, you know. But I what I've noticed is that when I don't have my glasses on, even like watching TV, I'm like, oh, I can't really see that like that far away sometimes. So I didn't want to like commit to reading without glasses. But oh, but then also the backup pair that broke too. So there was like a 3-week period where I was like without glasses, and I finally got them in. So I have them now. So I could probably sit down and finally read these. But yeah, it was weird. Like I was like, oh, I have time. I'm like, oh no, I don't want to strain my eyes like that much right now.
All I'm already the time staring at a in the screen. World, Eric.
Exactly. It was a Twilight Zone episode come to life. So,
yeah. Next question. Food question. Tonight I am having a tamale pie, which is a really larger deconstructed kind of tamale in a casserole dish. This is something I grew up having, and I was wondering if either of you has gone back to family favorites while we now cook more at home.
Huh.
So I have one.
Yeah.
We did not cook a ton at home growing up. Not a lot of sort of signature dishes. There were some for sure. Biscuits and gravy, which we have not retried. My grandmother's mac and cheese recipe, which that specifically we have not made, and that's just because I don't know. There's this 4 or 5 day period where we have milk, and we tend to be using it for cereal and milk and cookies. You know, the necessities. So we don't have it to make a roux for the mac and cheese. But growing up, we made what we always used to call sizzle burgers, which is just burgers but with Worcestershire sauce. And I did a little research. I'm pretty sure this was just a marketing gimmick that French's or Liam Perkins made up just to try and sell more Worcestershire sauce, but they are delicious. And so I made a couple of those last week, and instantly putting the Worcestershire on the burger patty took me back to being 13 or whatever and helping my parents make these. So
that's pretty fun. So I have a weird like thing. It's not that my mom didn't cook. She did every once in a while. But so my brothers and sisters are all older than me. Like my youngest brother is 10 years older than me. And like my parents got divorced when I was 2. So my mom like basically went back to work when I was like 3, I want to say. And so she was like, and by the time we moved out to Palm Springs, she was like a single mom working. And like already did like the 20 plus years of like being a homemaker and stuff and cooked every day. And so like just a lot of times she just didn't have time. So I did eat a lot of like fast food growing up, but also her things they'd be very utilitarian, like a quick like, you know, making some sort of meat in the oven, maybe a can of green beans or corn on the stove. And sometimes like maybe the potatoes, maybe a baked potato, but maybe like instead of fries, she would slice the potatoes and then sort of make those, cook those in the oven. And they'd be sort of like, you know, chip fries as it were, mm-hmm. as sort of a treat. I don't really do that a ton. So there's not like stuff that I'm thinking about like home other than like, say, for Christmas, I tend to make her Chex Mix recipe, and that's not really like cooking and stuff as it is to just adding flavors to it and things. So I tend to do that more in terms of a thinking about old things. That said, I have been cooking more. I'm probably going to buy a food processor this week because I want to start to make more salsa and chili at home, and I'm going to just go deeper into that. And so, I've been cooking quite a bit. And just sort of exploring here and there, and it's more like newer recipes to me as opposed to old. But yeah, I like it. Chili, we had a lot over the holidays at various things, so maybe that's it. And I really want to make a good chili within the next week here, so that's probably going to be the one that's closest to me in terms of like an old comfort food that I used to have.
That's this episode. I was thinking about the book question. Never Let Me Go by Kazuo Ishiguro. There you go.
All right.
There's
nice. One. Yeah, so, this is a little bit shorter, although we've been decent length on these weekly episodes. So hope you enjoy it. Maybe we'll have a little bit more of a structure I want to talk about next week, or maybe we won't. But either way, we'll try to make something that's fun to listen to. And thanks for listening, everybody. We'll talk to you next week. We'll be right back.